Whoa. Okay, that's not the entry I was planning. Okay, well, you guys are up there or back there. I don't want to be here. Is this okay? Is that better? All right. It's good to be here with you this evening, and I appreciate John and CJ Stewart for their participation, preparing our minds. John reading that long psalm that we're going to use as a springboard. We're not going to really get deeply into it. The Psalm 105 is one of nine of the 150 psalms that deals pretty explicitly with the history of the people of Israel and blends what we would call theology and history together. Theology, the study of God. History, as one of my students at Frieder Hardeman University said one time, the study of us. And so I like to think of it as theological history, God's partnership with us. And you saw how that psalm unfolded. It mentioned specific people who played a role, God's promises, fulfilling his promises. And I love the ending, praise the Lord. Praise Yahweh, they would have said. Praise the great I am. So what I want us to think about and try to think about intentionally, and some of you I think already do what I'm going to be talking about tonight, but think about how we can do something very similar. Not necessarily write songs. Not all of us are that musically gifted. It can be like David, a jack of all trades. But how we can tell stories, theological histories about God's partnership with us. And do that as a congregation. Do it face-to-face as Christian friends. And also do it around our dinner tables. Do it at family gatherings, at Christmas and at holidays. And talk about what God has done for us, his partnership with us, and the people who have touched us with their faith. So what I want to do is look at this theological history at three levels. We're going to start at the church level, the broader church level, and then talk about the congregational level, and then the family and individual levels. Now, church level, we can go all the way back to the day of Pentecost. There's so many things to draw from, but I'm going to pinpoint a specific time in history, early United States history. We'll tell a couple of stories, and I owe a debt to David Young, his book New Day, because he tells these stories very well. So he inspired me to tell these stories in the classroom, and I wanted to relate them to you tonight. But our setting for this first story of church history in a broader sense is in Logan County, Kentucky. The date is 1800, and Kentucky is becoming a land of promise. The Cumberland Gap is open. People are moving in. They're seeking new opportunities in life, new lands. It's a time of excitement with these new opportunities, but it's also a time of some uncertainty and insecurity. Some people have left behind kith and kin to the east. So you've got all these dynamics going on, and a man named James McGreedy, a Presbyterian minister, also moves into Kentucky, ministers to three different congregations, and he feels that the area that he's ministering to seriously needs spiritual uplift. He senses that the people are really dead, stagnant in their faith. So he gets people to pledge to have meetings every third Saturday to fast, to pray for spiritual renewal. Well, these meetings are going on, and one night he invites another friend of his, a fellow Presbyterian minister named William Hodge. Hodge addresses the crowd on that Saturday night and does a really good job, and he finishes his sermon. He and McGreedy leave. McGreedy goes at this point to his adjacent area, basically to call it a night and go to bed. Well, in the audience is another man, another minister. His name is up there, John McGee. And John McGee is not a Calvinist Presbyterian. The Presbyterians would believe you preach the message, it's up to God to move the heart of the recipient of the message. John McGee is a Methodist. He believes in the altar call. So he stands up, and he begins preaching, and he begins inviting people to respond to the gospel, and people respond. And the responses are overwhelmingly emotional. People are crying. Some people are laughing because they just feel the joy of salvation. And so one of the people there goes and finds McGreedy and says, you got to come find out. I mean, he would have used this wording in 1800. Basically, he's like, John McGee has hijacked your meeting. You need to check this out. So McGreedy goes and outside of his Presbyterian, his Calvinist experience, what's going on. And he watches, and he does have a choice here. He could choose out of his own experience, his own doctrine, his own ego, and shut this down. But as he's witnessing this event and people responding to McGee's gospel call, McGreedy begins to think, this may be the spiritual renewal I've been praying for. So he doesn't intervene. The meeting proceeds under McGreedy's leadership, and this begins a great revival. People come to this Red River Church to see what's going on. And one of those individuals is Barton W. Stone. He visits. He's inspired, and he wants to have a meeting of his own. He's in the bluegrass region of Kentucky, so he organizes his own meeting at Cane Ridge, 1801, tries to get the word out the best way he can in an age long before social media, but gets it out word of mouth. And on the day of his revival meeting, his camp meeting, he sees in the distance a great cloud. And at first he thinks this could be bad weather, a storm coming. And as the crowd comes closer to him, he sees it's a dust cloud, and it's the dust picked up by people on horseback, people on carriages, coming to his meeting. Eventually, an estimated 20,000 people attended the camp meeting at Cane Ridge. And this became one of the pivotal moments in what we call the Restoration Movement, or what scholars call the Stone-Campbell Movement, because Stone began to preach and long for Christian unity, and Christian unity in a New Testament church as far removed as, you know, human creeds as possible. And he joined his movement with a similar movement by Alexander Campbell, and this became part of the Churches of Christ that we know today. But it all really goes back to that night when James McGreedy decided to let something unfold. It was a bit out of his experience and his comfort zone. All this part of church history, part of our own history in Churches of Christ. And these two gentlemen up here, I'm looking at this screen, part of their legacy that they've given to us, and it's a very special spiritual legacy, going back to New Testament, what they would have called primitive forms, is congregational autonomy, something that Presbyterians like James McGreedy did not experience. But congregational autonomy, it's really a blessing that we sometimes take for granted. So I want to move next to the congregational level, stories we can talk about the Estes congregation. And I meant to bring with me, and I forgot it, But just recently, it's only been 7 years ago, we had a 100th anniversary celebration of the 1912 meetings held that really put the Estes congregation on the map, so to speak, even though there had been meetings going on in that area before. And the 100th anniversary, some of you remember it very vividly, the large crowds, the reunions, but part of that project was a booklet that was presented. And we still have copies available at the Welcome Center if you're interested. But in that booklet, there's a bit of the history of the congregation. And Red McCaskill, who had been a member of this congregation, wrote a pretty detailed history in the mid-1980s, and his history was drawn on and expanded. And that history mentions a lot of names, people who are long gone but who are part of the foundation of what became the Estes Church of Christ. My participation in that event involved doing some interviews. And I only interviewed three people, Mildred Beard, Doug Ross, and B.J. Naylor, David Ross. But I gleaned from their interviews some important information. And tonight, from David and from B.J., I want to share some of their stories about some specific moments, pivotal moments in the history of this congregation. This is a photo that appears in the 2012 publication. People gathered outside of the original building, original church building. And by the time David came in the 1950s, the church had grown. The capacity of this building was about 100 people. And it, you know, there was as it got into the 50s, there were more families with children. And there was a sense among some of the members that we need a new building. And there was problems about that need. The adjacent property around this building here was not for sale. So any move by the congregation would involve picking up and leaving. And a lot of the people in the congregation were very attached to this building, to the cemetery that was on the same property. They simply did not want to leave. They believed that the cemetery, the building were intertwined. The congregation and cemetery's life went together. So there was some opposition, but these discussions were going on. And then a member of the Henderson congregation, John L. Weeks, offered to donate 3 acres of land, basically, I guess, where we are now. Donate land to the congregation. which removed a possible major financial impediment to moving. But then there was still the idea, we move, we build the building. So David was telling me how many of the members were reluctant. They remembered vividly the experiences of the Great Depression and financial insecurity. This was a big leap of faith that some of them simply couldn't do because of their recent historical life experience. Others felt tied to the cemetery. But there were proponents of the move, opponents, and they had long discussions. And there was patience in letting different views be heard out. This was done, I think, in a very brotherly way. Also, this is a time before the congregation appointed elders. And so things function as business meetings of the men. And I've been in congregations where that was the procedure, and it can be a pretty difficult process of hearing so many different points of views. But eventually, the decision was made to move, and I've brought this photo. I meant to get to that earlier. But the decision was made to move, and David decided he was one of the proponents of the move, and he said, we've got to build a building. We're going to need to finance this building. The ultimate cost was $20,000. They did everything they could to cut costs. They even considered bringing in theater chairs, but decided to go with pews, which was a good choice. But men had to sign the deed, basically pledge their credit. And that's a difficult thing to do. I've been in congregations where people were scared that there's things going badly. You know, well, who's going to pay if the church goes down? Who's going to pay for it? The people who signed this deed. But he said, I signed the deed. He said, I guess I was too dumb to do otherwise. But I would say he had the faith to do that, to make that step, to sign his name to the deed, and this building was the result. And it's hard to imagine this congregation going in the direction it has had this move not been made. Its trajectory, its history would be very, very different. Because this building became the springboard for other activities, other people to come into the congregation, more stability as far as pulpit ministers, people coming to worship here, and families coming here and raising their children. I want to mention these two people, Brad Brumley, Betty Brumley. Brad became the preacher here in the early 1960s. And I read an interview with Brad. He says, I preached. I got the credit for what happened at Estes, but Betty did the work. And BJ corroborated that when I talked to him, because it was Betty who initiated a busing program to bring children from Henderson to Estes. And she would go out and visit the poorer neighborhoods of Henderson. And one of the issues when people were unchurched, and we'll explore this as we go, is they don't know what's going on in this building, the things you and I take for granted, because we're comfortable. A lot of us grew up with this. And so what do you wear? What do you do? And so some of these children lacked clothing that they felt was church-worthy. And so Betty took care of that. She bought them clothing. She clothed them. She brought them to Estes. And so that outreach, and Brad initiated an outreach to the mental hospital in Bolivar, they became, I think, some of the first community outreaches of the Estes congregation. Very important foundations for what we do today, all of it made possible by the individuals who decided to take advantage of Brother Weeks' offer and build a new congregational building here. And then I want to mention one other individual, jumping ahead a couple of decades. If the Brumleys helped to initiate a congregational outreach, it's part of our story, our theological history of God partnering with people. I want to mention Norman Hogan, who preached here in the 1980s. And Norman was a history and Bible professor at Freed-Hardeman and a minister, but he's really a frustrated wannabe missionary. He really regretted that he didn't go into full-time missions. So he led spring break campaigns, domestic campaigns to St. Louis, but he was involved very much in work in Europe, particularly in the United Kingdom. And that began Estes's putting its footprint in other areas of the world. Sponsoring Patty Boynes, I believe, was the first time, but engaging other continents, other people, other opportunities, and very much a part of our fabric today. You know, we pray for our missionaries, but this is really a big part of Norman's contribution to the congregation, just as the Brumleys contributed reaching out to the community, and then others contributed to building this building. As David said, this was a building that really was built by the Estes people over time and maintained by the Estes congregation. Having said all these things about the church level, because I think we should think about our congregational history, people who've laid the foundation for what we do today, people of faith, just as we're people of faith, and we want to do things for the glory of God, but I think they did, and we want to continue that. These people I showed on the screen, they're part of the cloud of witnesses that I believe cheer us on. and commend and pray for our efforts. But there's also the area of our individual lives, our individual walks. Sunday's morning sermon, Mark talked about stories. He mentioned Paul being very transparent about his own story. And we think about God's redemptive plan and how he partners with people. We see that in Psalm 105. He partners with us individually and with families, and he brings into our lives people who many times touch us spiritually in ways that we need at that moment. It just happens. So if you'll pardon the personal level of this, I'm going to tell a little bit about my family story, my individual story, a little bit about Kelda's story, just as an example, because we all have these stories. I know Larry and I spent one Sunday morning, he told me his story, and I love this story. And as a punchline, someone loves me in Texas. Remember that? Ask Larry to tell you his story, because we all have stories to tell, and I think it inspires us because we see likeness and we see differences in our stories. But we also see common threads, the personal connections that are so vital. So this photo, which, okay, it's appearing better up there. This 1960s photo of people dressing in 1960s clothing with 1960s hairstyles, the people on the left are my parents, Van and Ella Massey. Beside of them are Preston and Ollie Mae Vick. You don't meet many Ollie Mays anymore, but back in the 60s, they ran around a bit. But Preston Vick was my dad's boss at a job in Greenville, North Carolina. He was from Texas. My parents had grown up in the Raleigh, North Carolina area, so everybody was new to the area. And Preston's wife, Ollie Mae, was out of town one weekend. My mom said, "Why don't we have him over for dinner?" So my parents had him over for dinner. And Preston said, "Where are you going to church?" And my mom was from a Free Will Baptist background, and my parents had attended a Free Will Baptist church in the Clayton, North Carolina area. My dad was a Methodist, and so they decided, "We're moving to a new town. We'll go to the Methodist church for a while." So that's what they told Preston. And he said, "Well, I'm going to the Church of Christ. We meet in the local Rotary building. Yeah, it's nothing fancy, but we hope to have our own building soon. We'd like for you to come." So he left, and my parents talked, and they thought, "Well, when your boss invites you to church, you better come." So they went. And they show up to the Rotary building, and this man here, this is C.E. Mannon, who was a Freed Hardeman student back in the early 50s. At this time, he was in his early 30s, roughly the age of my parents. He was the preacher. He was sponsored by a congregation in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to plant a church in Greenville, North Carolina, because Eastern North Carolina is still today a mission area. And so that's what he was, being a domestic missionary. And so he preached in the Rotary building. My parents liked the message, the biblically based message. They liked the worship service. People were friendly. But they were puzzled because in this Rotary building hall was a piano that was unused, was unplayed during worship. And so, again, people come to church and they have questions. And my parents discussed their question among themselves. Why wasn't the piano played? And they thought, "Well, this is a small congregation. Maybe nobody knows how to play the piano." And so that's what they thought after that first service. They certainly learned otherwise because they asked a lot of questions, and C.E. answered them in a way that impressed them by going to Scripture. So that he baptized them, baptized my brother. I was an infant at the time. But this was how our family joined the church, and it came from a personal acquaintance, a personal touch, my dad's boss, but later the man he called his best friend, Preston Vick. This here is the Diamond Grove Church of Christ in rural eastern Madison County. And in the mid-1990s, I'm at Freed Hardeman University, but that doesn't mean that I'm on the spiritual high all the time any more than anybody else in this room. And so I was going through a bit of a time of, I guess you would say, a spiritual funk, and I decided I need to find a new church home, somewhere where, you know, I can go, camp out, maybe be needed, be used. I'll go to a small congregation. So I chose this congregation, and I was attending, became a member there. But I was still struggling a bit with my church attendance. I want to show these two old ladies from our church directory. The lady on the left is Agnes Robinson. The lady on the right is Frances Todd. They were in their 70s at the time. They lived into their early, mid-80s. They've since passed away to their reward. But they both became friends. Agnes on the left became my first really good friend at Diamond Grove. And one morning I was sitting beside her just before worship began. And Agnes turned to me and she said, "I know you're very tired. I know you work very hard." I was like, "What are you talking about?" She said, "Well, because you don't come to Bible study. You only come for worship." I'm like, oh my goodness. I mean, that was really slick. You know, have you ever been rebuked in a gentle way? And so I started coming to worship after that. I mean, coming to Bible study. But Frances, the lady on the right, drove Agnes. She was the transportation for both of them to go to church on this rural congregation. The roads aren't good to get there. And eventually Frances was unable to drive. So I started carrying Frances and Agnes to church because it wasn't out of my way to pick them up. And I was still, there were times when I just didn't feel like, oh, I don't want to go. But I knew that they relied on me for a ride because these faithful ladies of Christ, this was the congregation that they had known as when they were young girls. In their old age, they returned to the congregation of their birth, and they were there every Sunday. And they needed me to give them a ride. And that kept me going at times I wouldn't have kept going. Their faith helped to renew my faith in a very special way, just by being who they were, faithful ladies. And very important for me, got me back into our relationship with Christ, into Bible study, preparing me for what happened next, which was meeting Kelda. But before we get to Kelda, let's talk about her grandmother, who's in this particular picture. The young girl is Madeline, Kelda's niece, but the lady there is Clarice Burleson, who was known as Mamaw to her family. And Kelda's family had a background in Churches of Christ, but by the time Kelda was growing up, Mamaw was the only faithful member and faithful in her church attendance. And she was a widow, but she was at church when it opened. And so Kelda attended with Mamaw when she was younger. By Kelda's teenage years, she wasn't going with Mamaw, but she at least had this one individual in the family who was faithful. And Kelda was committed to God in prayer, was praying, but she wasn't going to church. It wasn't something her family was doing, but she had this, as she got into her teenage years, this feeling that I need to be in church. God is calling me to be in church. But having a grandmother attending church, that's one thing. But not having friends when you're a teenager at that congregation is another. And so Kelda was wanting to, but was kind of holding back because of that lack of a friend, somebody she knew. And she'd had one experience attending church in the classroom where, you know, it was an uncomfortable experience. And so she was reluctant to try it, but she was talking about it. So once Kelda got her driver's license and was feeling independent, she talked to her younger brother, Garrett, who is 13 months younger, and they talked about going to church. But they had questions because, again, I think we underestimate people who are outside of church don't know the things we take for granted. And they have questions. And they have insecurities about walking in the doors here because they don't know what they're going to experience. So Kelda and Garrick are talking about church and the schedule, Sunday mornings and Sunday nights. And Kelda's asked Garrick, can we go on Sunday morning? If we go to church, do we need to go on Sunday night? And Garrick, with the certitude that teenagers often have when they're totally ignorant of what's going on, Garrick said, no, we don't go on Sunday night. Sunday night is when people go who didn't go on Sunday morning. So we only have to go on Sunday mornings. They soon found out otherwise. And what happened in the Haley High School band, Kelda met a new friend, Shannon, who had moved to the area. She was a member of the Ninth Avenue Church of Christ, where Mamaw worshiped. She invited Kelda to church, and that became the catalyst. It was already in process, but having a friend, someone that Kelda knew, that became the impetus for Kelda and Garrick to go to the Ninth Avenue congregation and to be welcomed and to have a broader family, if you will, a youth group. And this is a photo. Kelda's the fourth girl from the left, the prettiest girl in the back row. But this is a photo just before Kelda came to Freed Hardeman University with some of the youth group. But meeting people beyond Shannon, having the friendship of Shannon, but meeting other friends, and then being welcomed by these friends' families, their parents saying, hey, why don't you come with us and do this? Became part of a larger family experience, not just a youth group, but parents welcoming Kelda, welcoming Garrett into their fold. And then having preachers like Andy Kaiser, who was the pulpit minister at Ninth Avenue at the time, and then Terry Gillum, who was the youth minister at the time. And one of the perks was that Terry would loan his Triumph Spitfire to some of the students. So he was a man of great faith. But anyway, Kelda finally, very quickly, decided to be baptized in October 1995. And her parents went to see Kelda baptized into Christ, and her parents realized, we've missed this. We've missed this experience. We've missed the singing. We've missed worship. And so they started returning to church. Now all of Kelda's family are faithful members. But you think back to Mamaw's faith, very similar to Agnes and Frances's faith, but also the personal touch of a friend, Shannon inviting Kelda, just as Preston Vick invited my parents. Having a friend, someone, I know someone here at Estes, I know someone at Ninth Avenue, I know someone in this small Greenville congregation, was a very important catalyst leading family members in our story to Christ. And I mentioned these different stories from the broader church level, where we see the influence of people like Stone and Campbell, to the Estes congregational level, and we see Brother Ross, and we see the Brumleys, and we see Brother Hogan. And then my story and Kelda's story, just to, I think, to illustrate that what we're reading in Psalm 105 is going on in our lives all the time. We have this blend of theology and history, or theological history in our own lives, our own stories, as a congregation, as a broader church, and as individuals and families. And so I encourage all of us, I encourage myself, to be more intentional about sharing these stories and sharing it with our children, sharing it with our grandchildren, sharing it with each other, sharing it in informal moments, and be thinking about how God partners with us, how he's partnered with other people to touch our lives, and what happened in all these situations. These individuals were, in very gentle ways, discipling others. I think sometimes we have the feeling we read scriptures, we read the Psalms, we read these great events, and we think we have to be spiritual heroes or athletes or something. And a lot of times it's just simply walking in faith and love, and then in a very gentle way, sharing Christ with people we know through an invitation, or in Agnes's case, through a very gentle rebuke, and disciple others. But can keep remembering these stories, and as we tell them, end with those words that ended Psalm 105. Praise the Lord. We're thinking a lot about stories that happened Sunday morning. I've been talking about stories tonight. I've been thinking a lot about stories lately because I think it's how we communicate, how we learn. And our lives are an unfolding story, if you will, part of God's bigger redemptive story. Whether we respond to the gospel or not, we're part of that story. But we know how stories go when we read a book. Sometimes things deviate. Sometimes you get in a bad chapter. But the wonderful thing, as I found out when I went to Diamond Grove, you can turn around your story and you can write a new chapter in Christ. So we always offer the invitation, just as John McGee offered the invitation at the Red River Church. If you are involved at this particular point in a period where the darkness is set in and you feel you need to come into the light, you need prayers of the church, you want to turn your story around, we invite you to come forward now as we stand and sing.